This is a download for the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/newsnight.
Hello. This week, Newsnight's editor Peter Barron announced to a cluster of desperate producers looking for ideas that Newsnight doesn't dabble in the dark arts. He was referring to the date that was getting a lot of people excited on Tuesday, the 6th of the 6th of the 6th, the day the new film of The Omen was released. Despite the collective sigh of disappointment, it seemed he felt that the suggestion the programme play out with a shot of Jeremy sprouting horns as his eyes glowed red would not deliver a fitting conclusion to the programme. But did you notice his head spinning? Oops, I think that was The Exorcist. However, there are some other magical moments in this week's podcast. Rather than a podcast, this could be a podiatry cast. Clearly someone worked some magic on Wayne Rooney's metatarsal. Never have so many known so much about the bones of the foot. Our very own superfan, Michael Crick, is safely into Germany and ready to bring us stories you never knew existed at the World Cup. But keeping things in perspective, we did report on other matters beside Wayne Rooney's fourth metatarsal. Coming up, the results of an inquiry into CIA rendition, the proposed Palestinian referendum, and the question that just won't go away, the controversial West Lothian question. But first, Iraq. On Monday, we reported on the escalating embarrassment at the White House as more emerged about who knew what and when over the alleged massacre by US Marines at Haditha last year. There had been some suggestions over the weekend that the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld should carry the can. Peter Marshall reported from Washington.
This is what we know so far. On November the 19th, a roadside bomb in Haditha kills one US Marine and wounds two others. On November the 20th, the Marines issue a statement saying simply that 15 civilians have been killed by the roadside bomb. According to new US press reports, by November the 21st, that's within 48 hours of the incident, the Marines' commanders allegedly knew their story wasn't true. The civilians had been shot dead. But publicly, they stuck with the story. At the start of this year, Time magazine investigate when they receive a video of the shooting's aftermath. Lieutenant General Peter Chiarelli responds by setting up a military inquiry. By March the 9th, he's confirmed 24 civilians have been shot. On March the 10th and 11th, Donald Rumsfeld and President Bush are told the preliminary results of that investigation. Other inquiries begin. On April the 7th, Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Chassani, the Marines' commander, is relieved of his post. Gary Solis was a Marine for 26 years. He drove a tank in Vietnam. Then he became a military lawyer, then judge, working on hundreds of cases. Yeah. Professor Solis says the Marines' initial story was obviously flawed. The numbers dead don't match roadside bombs, and the commander should have known.
It is a possibility that he was aware of what happened. And if he wasn't aware, should he have been aware? 24 civilians killed by a roadside bomb just is not something that should have gotten by him. So if he was aware of that and did nothing, took no action, didn't report it to a higher command, then he could be facing court-martial charges of his own.
Back at the Pentagon, they're facing constant speculation that Haditha was somehow inevitable, given the American troops' attitude to Iraqis.
One very senior retired military source has told me Haditha shows the careless brutality of US forces right across Iraq. They've been allowed to behave in that way, he said, because of the willful blindness of the Pentagon leadership. Once again this weekend, there have been renewed calls for the resignation of the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, in San Francisco now is Gary Myers, the military lawyer who defended US soldiers after the massacre at My Lai during the Vietnam War and after the prisoner abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib. He'll also be defending a Marine accused over the Haditha killings, if charges are brought. Do you find any comparison, any similarity between My Lai and what's said to have happened at Haditha?
Yeah, I emphasize what's said to have happened. None of us really has the slightest notion of what actually happened, and until we are able to get our hands on investigatory reports and the like, we really won't know. But making that rather large leap of faith, there clearly are similarities. And the principal one, I believe, is the fact that these young men in both circumstances were being subjected to an enemy that was unseen. In Vietnam, it was punji stakes and other booby traps. In Iraq, it's IEDs. And the loss of life coupled with the inability to engage the enemy is a prescription for disaster. if it is coupled with an absence of leadership. And I don't know what happened in Haditha as yet, but in that sense, there is a parallel. However, there is also this. Vietnam was populated by men who were conscripts, generally speaking, not nearly so well trained as these men. These are Marines. They are the very best we have. And the inquiry has to become, ultimately, is there any corporate responsibility associated with an outcome such as this?
But in the end,
inquiry would...
In the end, all soldiers are responsible for their own actions, whatever the environment, aren't they?
Well, easily said. Easily said.
Doesn't make it untrue.
I think that you... But you have to walk a mile in a man's shoes every once in a while to understand the facts and circumstances of a given case. I'm not here to apologize for anything. I am here to say, however, that I am greatly concerned at this juncture that this administration in our country is once again embarking on a program of isolation and vilification. I face this in Abu Ghraib, where these young people, all of whom were quite normal, were accused of being sadists by general officers, by cabinet members, and even by the president himself. And the one thing I want to make sure does not happen in this Haditha matter is that this same isolation, this attempt to divorce responsibility from all except those who are alleged perpetrators, does not occur.
On Wednesday, the results of a seven-month inquiry into the CIA process known as Rendition were released in a report for Europe's Human Rights Watchdog. The first detailed attempt to find out whether the United States not only transports terror suspects around the world, but may keep them in secret prisons, came to some damning conclusions. Notably, that the evidence suggests secret detention camps do exist in Europe, and that European governments connived with the practice. On the eve of its publication, Stephen Gray, who had exclusive access to the report, told us of its contents, and he travelled to Sana'a, capital of Yemen, to meet Mohamed Bashmila, one of the few people released from CIA so-called ghost detention.
I met Bashmila at the office of a local human rights organisation. In his first exclusive interview since he was released from prison in March, he described his 19 months detained in solitary confinement. He says he wasn't physically tortured. However, there was mental torture. One of the reasons was I was kept entirely alone. I didn't see anyone. Secondly, there was music 24 hours a day, so I couldn't sleep, read, or pray. Bashmila drew for us a sketch map of one of the most secret prisons where he was held. It's a place that held some of America's most important prisoners, key terrorist suspects whose arrests were announced by Washington but have since disappeared. Bashmila's story, he says, began when he was captured and then tortured in Jordan back in October 2003. He was then flown into US custody in Afghanistan and then months later moved onwards to another secret prison whose location is still unknown. Inside a cell measuring 10 feet by 13 feet, he was watched by video cameras and was shackled to the floor with a chain containing 110 links. The accounts of people like Bashmila have come to light because of the discovery of a fleet of jets used by the CIA. As Newsnight has reported before, the flight logs of these jets have revealed how they were used for the transfer by the United States of terrorist suspects to jails across the globe, a process known as rendition. But what has caused most controversy has been reports that among the destinations of the planes were secret jails in European countries. Last year, the Council of Europe, based in Strasbourg, asked Dick Marty, a Swiss former state prosecutor, to investigate. Newsnight has obtained an advance copy of his report. It accuses 14 countries in Europe of being involved in the CIA program of rendition and secret detention, a system, he says, which for Europe is based on an utterly alien legal approach. Marty describes what he calls a spider's web of rendition flights that has enveloped Europe. Countries like Spain, Turkey, Germany and Cyprus have, he says, provided staging posts for rendition operations. Portugal, Ireland and Greece are implicated as stop-off points for CIA flights. So is Britain, also accused of passing information about British citizens or residents, who have then faced both rendition and torture. Prisoners have also been captured for rendition in Italy, Sweden, Bosnia and Macedonia. Lastly, his most serious charges are levelled against Poland and Romania, where, he says, he has established new evidence that strengthens suspicions that CIA secret prisons were or are established on their soil, despite the fierce denials of both countries. All in all, he says that it is only through the intentional or grossly negligent collusion of the European partners that this web was able to spread also over Europe. Much of Marty's evidence came from flight plans of CIA jets filed with European air traffic controllers. He claims the data shows a clear pattern of what he calls rendition circuits, specific missions involving the transfer of prisoners. Flight plans obtained by the Council of Europe inquiry show trips not only to Romania, but also from Afghanistan to Poland. Mysteriously, despite this official evidence, the Polish authorities told the inquiry they had no record of the plane's visits. So where was Mohamed Bashmileth think he was held?
We couldn't determine what place we were in because I was taken from prison to prison without being able to hear, see, or feel. I couldn't determine where I was in the world.
There were some hints about his location. The weather felt very cold and the food seemed European. White rice and canned beef, even Kit Kat bars. Bashmileth also said that, unlike in Arab countries, the time of sunset prayer, provided by his guards, was as late as 8:45 p.m. Bashmileth wasn't told a thing about where in the world he was being held, and nor will the CIA say anything about the location of its secret prisons. So following the trail of the CIA's ghost prisoners is about piecing together a series of clues. I went to an astronomer to ask what the times of sunset prayer in Bashmileth's prison would reveal about its location.
8:45 p.m. for a latest time of sunset does constrain the position of the prisoner to some extent. Within the time zone that's an hour ahead of Greenwich, you're looking at somewhere either in eastern Poland or Slovakia or Hungary or just possibly a little further south. You couldn't be as far west as Germany as the latest time of sunset. Similarly, you wouldn't be in the UK because the sun, as we all know, sets a lot later at this time of year. So it does constrain it to a certain extent.
Other clues come from Bashmileth's journey to the secret jail. Blindfolded, he was taken from Afghanistan in April 2004 and flown by jet for some 5 hours, followed by around 2 hours in a helicopter. The prison, known to the CIA as a black site, was also about 7 hours from Yemen, where he was returned in May last year. Although his memory may be poor, and he could have been deceived, all these clues point to a place of detention in northeast Europe. Although there's too little information to say exactly where he was held, there are enough questions raised by his case and by the Council of Europe inquiry to keep the pressure up on European governments to reveal what they really know about the CIA's renditions.
It's been an interesting week for the Palestinians. Their president, Mahmoud Abbas, gave the Hamas-dominated government a further 48 hours on Tuesday to recognise the State of Israel. Otherwise, he'd put the idea to the people in a referendum. Mr. Abbas's plan has already been approved by the PLO, but Hamas has said any such referendum would be illegal. Meanwhile, Western donors are refusing aid to the Palestinians until such time as they accept Israel's right to exist. On Tuesday, Jeremy spoke to Dr. Abdul Aziz Al-Duwak. He's the Speaker of the Palestinian Parliament, but was elected there as a member of Hamas. Jeremy asked him whether the Palestinian people thought being denied Western aid was a price worth paying for not making a statement recognizing Israel.
It is not a matter of Western aid. The West, especially the United States, in a matter of injustice, is denying our money, which donated by the Arab and the Muslim countries, and Israel is denying us our money, which is the tax which Israel collects on our behalf for the goods that we import from Israel to our territories.
But if the State of Israel has already been recognized by the previous PLO administration, what is the problem about simply restating that and lifting the embargo?
It's a matter of principle. Israel is supposed to recognize the occupied people. It is not the other way around. And we would never go to the same mistake that our brethren have done by recognizing Israel and taking nothing as a result of that recognition. So there should be a price for that.
But the price of it, as far as the Palestinian people are concerned, is that people are going to go hungry.
The people are hungry already, but they insist that they have to keep their steadfastness until they can achieve their national rights, which have been denied for a long time so far.
On Wednesday, we dared to ask the West Lothian question. Since 1999, Scotland's had its own parliament and Wales its own assembly. But legislation in England for such areas as health, education and transport goes through the Westminster Parliament, with non-English MPs able to vote on them, sometimes decisively. The question is so-called because the then MP for the area, Tam Dalziel, coined it, and it's become shorthand for the tensions that have arisen over what many regard as an unfair anomaly. David Grossman reports.
In 2004, the Higher Education Bill brought in tuition fees for England. The government won by a majority of 28. But strip out MPs from non-English constituencies and the government would have actually lost by 2 votes. Likewise, the 2003 Health and Social Care Bill that made English elderly patients pay for personal care in hospital. It was passed with a government majority of 17 votes. Take away MPs from non-English constituencies and the government would have actually lost by 17 votes. The former Conservative Home Secretary, Kenneth Baker, has introduced a bill into Parliament that would stop MPs from non-English constituencies voting on exclusively English legislation.
I'm in favour of a United Kingdom remaining as a United Kingdom, but you'll only keep the United Kingdom united if you're fair to the constituent parts of the United Kingdom. I am a unionist, and I think the union would be at threat if this is not corrected.
The government had hoped to introduce elected regional assemblies in England to redress the balance. But the only referendum to bring in one of these in the northeast was lost decisively. So where to now? Well, Labour says that changing voting rights at Westminster is certainly not the answer.
Do you go down a route of saying you have a United Kingdom Parliament and you live with an anomaly? If by living with that anomaly you can sustain and secure the future of the Union.
Lord Sewell, Labour's former Scotland minister.
I think the danger if you have two-tier MPs that you encourage that separation more, and that will have the unintended consequences of putting the union at threat.
But might there be another reason why Labour is not keen to leave English legislation to MPs from England? When Labour came to power, they won 2.6 million more English votes than the Tories. By 2001, that lead had been cut to 1.4 million. But by the 2005 general election, the Conservatives actually polled 58,000 more votes in England than Labour did. No wonder some Labour MPs are alarmed. Alan Williams is the longest-serving MP. He represents a Welsh seat for Labour.
A normal Labour government doesn't have a majority of England members. Its majority is made up with the addition of the Scots, the Welsh and the Irish.
So that could be the end of Labour majority government for a while?
Well, you've managed to understand it very simply straight away. Unfortunately, my political seniors lack your perspicacity and they seem unable to recognise the logic of it.
The Chancellor, Gordon Brown, hopes to be the next Prime Minister. He spends a great deal of time celebrating Britishness. Not surprising, a recent poll for the BBC suggests that a majority of UK voters thought that post-devolution, a Scottish MP could not be Prime Minister. And there's even disquiet about current Scottish Cabinet Ministers.
I think it's unacceptable for John Reid to be Home Secretary.
Lord Baker again.
He said at an earlier stage in his career, I could never be Home Secretary because I'm Scottish. He's in the position where he can make decisions about the Lancashire Police Force, but not about the Lanarkshire Police Force, which he represents. Similarly with Douglas Alexander, the Minister for Transport. He can make decisions about roads in the county where I live, Sussex, but he can't make any decisions about roads in Scotland. He can impose road charging in England, but cannot do it in Scotland. This is actually unacceptable. It's one of the consequences of devolution, which must be put right.
Well, we tentatively opened up the Newsnight inbox the following morning to find it heaving with your emails. We like to present a balanced debate on Newsnight, but it can be difficult when so many of your answers to the West Lothian question say the same thing.
Independence!
Screamed Susan Rankin from London.
The English are beginning to realise how much they've been shortchanged by this government's devolution policy,
remarked Frances Lade from Hitchin.
And accountable MPs from Scotland ruling on English affairs are an abomination to democracy.
And Nigel Perry from Bath added,
there is no question. It's perfectly obvious that Scottish MPs should no longer be deciding matters which do not affect Scotland.
But Tom Brooks Pollock from London wanted to know,
what is the objection here? That Scottish voters exercise disproportionate influence over the making of English laws?
Think of the 80s. The industrial north, Wales, Scotland, etc. were governed by Tory governments they had rejected. The fact is that all systems of representative democracy will apportion influence disproportionately, in one way or another. And what we have really isn't too bad.
Well, there are many more comments on our website at bbc.co.uk/newsnight, where you can continue to cram our inbox with rants, raves and reviews on this or any other subject we may or may not have covered. Staying with web matters, something a little different now. Scarcely a week goes by without a Hollywood-inspired police raid on some hacker server somewhere in the world, or else a blockbuster movie dumped onto the internet within a day of its cinema release. The war between big media and some quarters of cyberspace is vicious and long-standing. But the conflict is also an ideological one, between two different modes of thought that sometimes seem unable to ever understand one another, let alone find common ground. Newsnight's uber geek Adam Livingston dispatched his agents to seek out the most powerful voices on each side of the divide to see if they had any common ground at all. John Perry Barlow is a former lyricist for the Grateful Dead, a band who famously gave away their music for free. He went on to create the Electronic Freedom Foundation, dedicated to keeping corporate and government tanks off the astroturf of cyberspace. Dan Glickman used to serve in Bill Clinton's cabinet, but now he's president of the Motion Picture Association of America, the body that represents the collective political will of the Hollywood studios. Here they are, edited head-to-head, beginning with John Perry Barlow.
I don't think that the movie industry is any more ready than any other part of the information industries to adapt itself to the information age. But it's going to go there one way or the other, and whatever its cries of protest growing pains, it'll make it eventually. It's just going to do everything it can, as the record industry has done, as the publishing industry has done, to stop progress in that direction until it gets its act together. But it'll go there.
I think John Perry Barlow is actually the one who's creating a disservice for the consumers, because you see, if you don't adequately compensate the artist, the director, the creator, the actor, they won't do it in the first place. So people won't get movies, TV shows, books, music, songs, all these wonderful things that we like. So we should be protecting our copyright, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be looking for new ways to get that content to people in modern ways, particularly young people who have understand computers and electronic equipment and the internet very, very, very well.
These are aging industries run by aging men, and they're up against 17-year-olds who have turned themselves into electronic Hezbollah because they resent the content industry for its proprietary practices. And I don't have a question about who's going to win that one eventually. There are a lot of kids out there copying and distributing movies, not because they care about seeing the movies or sharing them with their friends, but because they want to stick it to the movie business. It's widely assumed that you can't compete with free, and that seems like a reasonable thing to think. But this has not been my experience. I mean, I have made a fair amount of money over the years writing songs for the Grateful Dead, who allowed their fans to tape their concerts. We were at one point the biggest grossing performing act in the United States, and most of our records went platinum sooner or later. You know, it's an economic model that has worked in my experience, and I think it does work. It's just that it seems like it wouldn't. It seems counterintuitive.
It is ridiculous to believe that you can give product away for free and be more successful. I mean, it defies the laws of nature. Would a clothing store give all their clothes for free? A car dealership give all their cars for free? Of course not. Now, it doesn't mean you don't do some promotions and you don't use advertising creatively, but nobody can make if they don't make a profit in this world, they're out of business. That's just the laws of human nature.
If I were to encounter Dan Glickman on the street, and we were to have a civilized conversation about this subject, which would be a long shot, I'd tell him to relax. I'd tell him to spend less of the resources of his industry on fighting the inevitable and more on learning about the conditions that they find themselves in and recognizing the opportunities, which I think are vast and very encouraging. But they can't get to those opportunities until they quit trying to stop progress.
First of all, I tell John Perry Barlow that I'm very relaxed, and if we met each other, we'd probably have a very good time. But all of us kind of need to chill out. The fact of the matter is that people who create content for movies and television have to make a profit. If they don't, you won't see all this wonderful stuff and listen to it. But he is right to the extent that we need to be finding new and different ways to get our content to people, whether it's internet or whether it's iPod or whether it's remotely accessed at various parts of the world or whether it's on machines that we can't even dream about right now. So, and frankly, all of our companies are working very aggressively on this because if they don't, the consumer will not be satisfied. And in this business, the consumer is king and queen. If you don't make them happy, they won't buy your product.
I've got good news and bad news and good news. And the good news is that you guys have managed to buy every major legislative body on the planet, and the courts are even with you. So you've done a great job there, and you should congratulate yourself. But, you know, the problem is, the bad news is that you're up against a dedicated foe that is younger and smarter than you are and will be alive when you're dead. I mean, you're 55 years old and these kids are 17 and they're just smarter than you are. So you're going to lose that one. But the good news is that you guys are mean sons of bitches and you've been figuring out ways to rip off audiences and artists for centuries, really. And all you got to do is get out of bed a little earlier in the morning for a spell and you'll find new ways to do this. I have every faith in you and you should give yourselves a little credit.
Look, if our companies do not get the digital age, they will not be in business 3, 4, 5 years from now. I mean, the fact of the matter is we are in the digital age. The bottom line is that movies are this enormously powerful medium that change people's lives. I mean, we can talk about all these technical terms all we want, but the fact is there are very few things in life that actually make people happy, make people smile, motivate you, sometimes scare you, inspire you. Many people have no joy to their life except listening and watching to the entertainment that we provide, and we want to keep that.
On Thursday morning, news emerged that militant leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had been killed in a strike by U.S. forces. Robin Densler reports on the man who has been blamed for thousands of deaths in Iraq.
He was considered the mastermind of terror, with a reputation that rivaled even that of bin Laden. The man who forced the United Nations to pull out of Iraq, personally killed Western hostages, and planned to plunge the country into civil war, with Sunni pitted against Shia.
Know that we'll sacrifice our blood and bodies to prevent you from achieving your dreams.
But now Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is dead, and the new Iraqi government, desperate for good news, is celebrating.
This is a story of how a one-time petty criminal took on the United States, the new government of Iraq, and indeed his own government, by using both carefully targeted and at times utterly random brutality, directed at Westerners, Iraqis, and even fellow Jordanians. Al-Zarqawi, literally the man from Zarqa, was born in a little town in Jordan and died over the border in Iraq with a $25 million bounty on his head, equal to that on bin Laden. The lowlife had become the second most wanted man in the world.
Zarqa is a dusty, sprawling city where Zarqawi's family continued to live while he was on the run. As a youngster, he was regarded as a bit of a thug, but a forceful young man with the ability to make others follow. He travelled to Afghanistan, hoping to fight the Russians, like Osama bin Laden. And back in Jordan in 93, he was arrested when the authorities found bombs and rifles in his house. In prison, he developed his violent philosophy. Freed in an amnesty, he travelled to Europe and back to Afghanistan, where he renewed his acquaintance with bin Laden. It was at his request, according to US officials, that he then moved to Iraq and developed links with the fundamentalist Ansar al-Islam, which, until the Iraqi invasion, operated from an enclave in Iraqi Kurdistan, way up here in the mountains along the Iranian border. By the time of the Iraq invasion, Zarqawi had moved down from the mountains to begin his new campaign. His tactics were brutal but with clear objectives. On August the 19th, 2003, he was held responsible for the bombing of the UN office in Baghdad. 23 people died, including the UN envoy, Sergio Vieira de Mello. The UN pulled out, and now the Americans were left alone in Baghdad to try to install a new government. He followed up with a campaign of kidnapping and execution aimed at Westerners who remained. His Tawhid and Jihad group beheaded hostages, including the American Nick Berg in May 2004, and a Briton, Kenneth Bigley, 5 months later, with Zarqawi himself possibly wielding the knife. There was another tactic, to try to provoke civil war between Sunnis like himself and Shia groups. The bombing of the shrine in Najaf in August 2003 led to fury among the Shias and was followed by the killings of Shia pilgrims in Karbala and in Baghdad on March 1, 2004, on the most holy day of the Shia year. Last year, he briefly turned his sights back on his old homeland with triple suicide bombings in the Jordanian capital in November, killing 60 people. By now, with Zarqawi receiving so much publicity, there were reports of tensions between him and bin Laden, with Zarqawi urged to shoot rather than behead hostages because he was alienating Muslims. This year, Zarqawi had become bolder still, even showing himself in a video clip and firing a machine gun in the desert. So what happens next? News of Zarqawi's death led to celebration in Baghdad today, though it's acknowledged that his group are most certainly not the only insurgents. Indeed, there have been suggestions that some Iraqi supporters of al-Qaeda are uneasy with the foreign jihadis. His death is a major development, but no one expects an early end to the violence.
Well, John Bolton, the US ambassador to the United Nations and one of the leading hawks in the Bush administration, was in London today. He gave me his reaction to the killing of Zarqawi.
This is a very significant development, and obviously we all hope will deal a grievous blow to the terrorism inside Iraq. The accomplishments of the Iraqi people in the series of elections and referenda they've held have really been noteworthy, but obviously the security situation has continued to be problematic. Getting Zarqawi was a high priority, so this is a significant success.
What George Bush was saying was that it was Special Forces acting on Iraqi intelligence. The Jordanians are also claiming an intelligence input as well.
Well, I think cooperation and intelligence sharing against al-Qaeda and terrorism generally is a high priority, and if that's the way it came together, that's good news.
There was what is sadly called collateral damage. We know already that 6 civilians were killed, including woman and child. When you are, in a sense, dispensing summary justice, surely, in terms of keeping the population on side, you can't afford to have those kind of civilian casualties.
Nobody is happy with any kind of civilian casualties, but let's understand why they arise. When groups like al-Qaeda are carrying on terrorist operations and hiding in the civilian population in violation of all civilized rules of war, they're the ones that make this circumstance inevitable. And I can tell you that the American forces and the other coalition forces in Iraq operate under strict rules of engagement. There is a hidden fact here, of course. The American army is filled with human beings, and sometimes they make mistakes. But they are mistakes. They are not done intentionally.
George Bush himself, though, said that Zarqawi's death would not be an end to sectarian violence. I mean, it's possible to overstate the importance of this strike.
It is, and that's why I think the president chose his words as he did. But obviously, the elimination of Zarqawi has been a high priority.
Just recently, President Bush said that there had been mistakes made by him in Iraq. He said last month he regretted his tough talk, conceding that his bring-it-on dare to insurgents in the summer of 2003 and the wanted dead or alive taunt to Osama bin Laden had sent the wrong signals to people. That it was a kind of tacit admission that perhaps that in itself fueled opposition to coalition forces.
I don't think that's exactly right. And I think the president's in a damned if you do, damned if you don't position. For years, his opposition has been saying, admit mistakes, admit mistakes. So then he turns around and admits, he being a human being too, you know how that works, that he had made mistakes. And his critics then focus on that.
Do you think you made mistakes too in things you said?
I have no doubt I've made mistakes. Reporters just love talking about mistakes.
Well, no, but some of them are kind of maybe regarded as fairly grand mistakes. For example, was there a failure in post-war planning, given you that you knew when you were going into Iraq, was there a failure in post-war planning which has led, in part, to the insurgency?
Well, I think that no one could really have predicted what the circumstances were going to be in post-war Iraq. This is a very difficult circumstance for anyone, and I don't think you could plan that completely in advance.
And our own Martha Carney's had a lot on her plate recently, and I'm not talking about the cakes and the politics pod in the Newsnight office. As chair of the Orange Prize for Fiction, she's had lots of reading to get through before she and her fellow judges awarded this year's prize to Zadie Smith for her novel On Beauty. And last week, Martha was in the chair for Newsnight Review, with guests Charles Summers Smith, Echo Weshin, Matthew D'Ancona and Sue Perkins. Leaving prize-winning literature to one side, Martha and the panel indulged in two slices of 70s film remakes. Poseidon, based on the 1972 disaster epic The Poseidon Adventure, and The Omen, based on The Omen from 1976. Both films received something of a savaging from the panel, with Echo Eshin first up.
I tell you what, to be honest, The Omen remake is one of the worst films I've ever seen in my life. If not, in fact, the worst film I've ever seen in my life. And I do not exaggerate, because it's a completely redundant, completely clunking, completely leaden film. Forget about the original. This is just a terrible, terrible piece of work. I mean, the original Omen had a sort of chilly grace to it. You know, it was pulpy, but it was also quite classy because it's the first time we'd seen that film, Son of the Devil, and so on and so on. This film is history repeated as farce.
It surely can't be worse than Poseidon. I'm amazed that you found a film that's worse. Poseidon is a film that they've obviously said, well, we've got 89 minutes of special effects and CGI, so we've got 1 minute to do a little bit of character backstory. Tell you what, let's have a gay man. How do we do that? Let's give him an earring, a nice close crop, he'll order a £5,000 bottle of wine, and that's it. And let's move on to the next stereotype. And it was comic. It was like underwater pantomime. And I actually thought, in comparison, The Omen fared quite well.
To be honest, I couldn't disagree more. At least Poseidon had in its favour the fact that it had some sort of momentum and movement. It's directed by Wolfgang Petersen, who's made a number of movies set in peril on the sea before, like The Perfect Storm and Das Boot. And so he knows how to keep things moving. It's an action movie, it's shallow, it's empty, but at least it moves. The Omen, my God! I was in shock!
About the ironic
and I wasn't
casting?
Scared, I was just...
But Charles, we're quite lucky having you here, because in fact you're fresh to both of these. So I don't know how you've escaped all these Christmases, but you haven't seen Poseidon Adventure or The Omen. So what did you think of the remake?
I'm with Sue. I really did not like Poseidon. I thought it was terrible. I haven't seen either of the originals, and I'm embarrassed to say, contrary to Echo, I rather enjoyed The Omen.
How?
It's a kind of straight, quite entertaining horror movie.
Yes.
And it scared me, and it had a pace and a sense of characterization, and it was well acted. Whereas Poseidon was, to me, completely vapid and had no excitement whatsoever. It was just fancy graphics.
I mean, Matthew, it was very faithful to the original, The Omen, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, it was beyond parody in its faithfulness. And it was a tragic example of... You take terrific actors and actresses like Liev Schreiber and Julia Stiles and Mia Farrow. How can you come up with this disaster of a movie? I don't understand. I mean, Poseidon, I have to say, I thought was equally terrible. Difficult to choose the size of the turkeys.
Come on, worse.
I think probably worse, but the only characters I sympathised with were Richard Dreyfuss trying to kill himself in Poseidon, and the nanny in The Omen who actually did kill herself, because it seemed to
very
me
early
the
on.
Only very early
yeah.
on, quite perfectly rational behaviour by the actors.
That's about it. Before I go, we read this week of the imminent arrival of the iPoem, a new website to be launched in October, offering a selection of poems to download, news that was welcomed by Andrew Motion, the Poet Laureate. Inspired, we thought we'd leave you with a little podcast poetry of our own. Ian McMillan, Barnsley poet and familiar face on Newsnight Review, is going to be contributing to the new site. But he's recorded a reading for us of a ditty he composed while waiting to meet someone at the BBC earlier this week. He's called it McMillan's Podlude. Enjoy.
I was wandering lonely, scattering stanzas that floated and folded like paper dancers, and they lay on the floor discarded. But now a revolution started, with verses straight from my mouth to your ear, poems hanging in the air, poems crystal clear. This is a brand new form that started to scan. I'm an electronic bard, a plugged-in man, and as Wordsworth should have said, I pod, therefore I am.